Did the State Ethics Commission illegally leak information to Governor Cuomo concerning the fate of his disgraced former aide, Joe Prococo? We'll have the latest on a secret investigation by the Inspector General. We'll speak to a doctor on a state-appointed board that's investigating the cause of maternal deaths in New York. And we'll have analysis of the week's headlines on the Reporters Roundtable. Casey Seiler of the Times Union will talk to Brendan Lyons and Bill Mahoney of Politico New York. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Welcome to New York Now. I'm Ray Suarez. Here's a look at the latest headlines in state news. Governor Andrew Cuomo threatened this week to revoke National Grid's license to operate in New York City and Long Island. In a letter, Cuomo accused the utility of mishandling its supply system after it imposed a moratorium on gas hookups for customers in the region. The governor and the utility have been locked in a months-long standoff after the state blocked construction of a natural gas pipeline running through New York. National Grid says that pipeline is essential to meeting rising energy demand. A number of county clerks across upstate New York are refusing to grant driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. The clerks, mainly in conservative-leaning counties, are protesting the state's new green light law, due to take effect next month. Last week, a federal judge threw out a case filed by the Erie County Clerk to block the law. Supporters say it will help undocumented immigrants avoid deportation for smaller offenses like traffic violations. Opponents say it violates laws that protect national security. New York's Public Finance Commission voted this week to adopt new donation limits for state assembly and state senate elections. The new preliminary limits would be $5,000 per donor for the assembly and $10,000 for the Senate. The commission is due to issue its recommendations on a new system of campaign finance on the day before Thanksgiving. The State Comptroller's Office says this year, New York saw its highest one-year increase in state property taxes since 2014. A new report from the office says local taxes bumped up 2.4% since 2018. And finally, allegations that Governor Cuomo was illegally briefed on state ethics panel business gained steam this week. The Times Union reported that the Inspector General conducted a secret investigation of the alleged breach earlier this year after an ethics panel member filed a complaint. Here to give us more insight into this breaking story, I'm joined by Casey Seiler of the Times Union.
Hi, Ray.
Casey, as always, welcome.
Good to be here.
First, let's start with the rules. People might say, well, he's the governor. He should know what's going on. What do the rules say about what he can know about this?
The bylaws governing Jacobs say that its internal votes on whether or not to pursue an investigation cannot be disclosed publicly. To that extent, and to many others, Jacobs is a real black box. That has been the subject of much of the criticism about Jacobs. Other criticisms, of course, have included the fact that the governor apparently has too much power over its membership and its deliberations.
What did your paper find about what the governor has been told, what he knows, what someone's been leaking to him?
Those are very good questions, some of which are unanswered. This goes to a complaint that was filed by Julie Garcia, who is a North Country attorney, a former district attorney. She is an appointee of Carl Hastie, the assembly speaker. After a Jacobs meeting in January, she was on her way back home when she received communication from an assembly aide, as yet unnamed, that said that the governor had reached out to Speaker Hastie and expressed his displeasure with the way that some of the appointees had voted on a matter that had occurred in that day's Jacobs meeting. Now, Garcia will not talk about what the matter was that they voted on, and will not talk about the vote tally because of the rules I just mentioned. But she was clearly disturbed at the prospect that somebody had leaked to the governor's office. And we know from other sources and from legal cases that we had been following that at the time, Jacobs had been compelled by a judge to vote on whether or not to conduct an investigation into allegations that Joe Prococo, the governor's former deputy executive secretary, had, during a period of time in 2014, multiple months when Prococo was managing the governor's reelection campaign, that he had essentially worked out of the governor's official gubernatorial office doing campaign business, which would be a clear violation of public officers' law.
Okay, so you found that the rules may have been broken. What's the downstream effect? Does this blow up the whole investigation? What happens now?
So Ms. Garcia communicated with the executive director of J-COPE, who at the time was Seth Agata. He is now gone. And Agata, once again, according to J-COPE's rules, called the inspector general's office, who conducted an investigation. The lead inspector general, Letizia Taliaferro, is a former J-COPE executive director, as well as being a former Cuomo aide, which Agata was as well, before heading to J-COPE. That's another part of the problem here. The investigation concluded in early October with a letter that we have not seen that said that these allegations of a leak could not be substantiated, but numerous questions remain.
We'll talk more about this investigation coming up on the Reporters Roundtable later in the program. According to the Centers for Disease Control, about 700 women die each year in the United States from pregnancy-related complications. 3 out of 5 of those deaths, the CDC says, are preventable. Women of color are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from complications during pregnancy or childbirth. New York ranks 30th in the nation for maternal mortality rates. With me now is Dr. Bernard Eng. He's the chair of the pathology department at Ellis Hospital in Schenectady. He's also on the state's new Maternal Mortality Review Board. The board has been assigned to investigate maternal deaths in New York. Dr. Eng, welcome.
Thank you.
Why was the board created? When you are able to look at whole at the state, what do you hope to find out?
Well, as stated by the findings in the CDC, the cost of women dying from more pregnancy-related complication have gone up, and the board was created to number one investigate the cause of that increase, and also the dive a little deeper into what might be attributing to the disparity between maternal mortality in Black women versus white and others in the population.
Maternal mortality often follows income lines, but the United States has a higher rate of death in childbirth than other rich nations. Why is that?
A number of factors might be at play. For example, nutritional factor, the epidemic of obesity, other factor that has been evolving over the past decade, such as the opioid epidemic that we're seeing, all of those might play a role in what we're seeing.
So you'll gather data from Buffalo in the west all the way to Suffolk County on the east, and once you know why women are getting in trouble in pregnancy in New York State, can you create steps to deal with it? Can you lower that number of women who will die in childbirth in New York?
That is one of the mission of the Maternal Mortality Review Board. And to do so, we are employing a uniform, standardized, systematic way of cataloging the type of findings associated with each death. And hopefully from that, some pattern would evolve, and that we can use that to create a best practice recommendation that can be adopted across the state.
A lot of the women who get in trouble in late in pregnancy and end up having complications that lead to death have had very little prenatal care. Are the things that you could find out if they went to the doctor more often and sooner that would lower the number of deaths when childbirth finally comes?
Well, that's one of the assumption that the availability and the use of prenatal care might be a factor. But another thing that was found right now is that if we look at mortality among Black women, that the death rate is still have that disproportionality regardless of their level of education. So if we can infer if that is associated with access or and availability to prenatal care, that kind of cloud the picture a little bit. So one of the hope of the using a systematic approach in analyzing maternal mortality is to find out what exactly is the reason for that disparity.
So if we were to correct for things like prenatal care, Black women still die at a higher rate?
Well, right now it appears so. But again, this is just based on pure statistic alone without actually analyzing the individual case. And once the review process begin, hopefully we'll get a little bit more clarity as to the reason behind that.
New York is, as we heard, better than most states, but still with a lot of room for improvement. There are 29 states with lower rates. But it would be a challenge, I would think, given the fact that New York is both urban and rural, some very high concentrations of wealth and high concentrations of poverty. It's a very heterogeneous state. It's kind of hard to make a rule about what to do in New York.
Right, that is definitely one of the challenge for any sort of policy for this state because of that seemingly huge difference between the metropolitan area and the upstate area. But if we're talking about from the medical practitioner standpoint, a tremendous amount of benefit can still be gained because hopefully some of the findings that we will come up with, some of the recommendations we'll come up with, will allow individual practitioner to recognize a patient that might be at a particular higher risk and to also start looking out for any sort of complication of disease process that might result in a poor outcome. One of the things the board is tasked to do is to provide education, and that also includes having people and patient and practitioner aware that while the name is to look at maternal mortality, sometimes the process that eventually could lead to mortality occurs during the pregnancy itself, not just from childbirth.
Both in New York and nationwide, the age at first childbirth has been rising. Is this something that could be pushing those maternal mortality rates?
That has certainly could be a cause because as the classification of a high-risk pregnancy is a mother whose maternal age is greater than 35. So as we see that change in pattern of when women are delaying their pregnancy, that can certainly be a factor that we can look into.
Well, good luck with the board's work. Dr. Bernard Eng, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. I'm at the Reporters Roundtable, where I'm happy to be joined by Brendan Lyons, Capitol Bureau Chief and Investigations Editor at my own paper, The Times Union, and Bill Mahoney from Politico. Thanks very much for coming in, both of you. So, Brendan, we talked at the top of the show about the story that you broke on Wednesday afternoon about this alleged leak in the investigation involving Jacob. What are the questions that remain as we talk Friday morning?
Well, I guess one of the top questions is, did this incident happen? You know, there's an allegation that the Inspector General investigated whether the voting of the commission that's supposed to be taking place in secret was leaked out, was made its way to the governor, who then had a conversation with the speaker in which he questioned the loyalty, if you will, of some of the speaker's appointees to the panel who had apparently voted against the governor. The IG did an investigation that was largely done, it was done in secret, and went on for about 10 months before they said they could not substantiate the allegations. But what's left now is, how can you do this investigation without interviewing the two people who are alleged to have that conversation? And there's no indication that they questioned either Carl Hastie or Governor Cuomo. And you saw today, this week, someone came forward, or another commissioner came out and supported
Julie
Garcia, that's right, in some substance, saying that her concerns are well-founded. And that's a commissioner who has been there from day one. So I think that carries a lot of weight with it.
When the responses that we've gotten so far from Carl Hastie's office and Andrew Cuomo's office, Hastie's spokesman said that Hastie does not recall having a conversation like that with the governor. The governor's office will not respond. And when you spoke to Rich Azzopardi, the governor's spokesman, on Thursday, he said he did not know if the governor had spoken to the IG, as if somehow Rich Azzopardi cannot contact the governor to ask him that question.
And then directed us to contact the IG for that information, who said that they don't discuss the details of their investigations.
The IG's letter that was written to Jacob that said that this could not be substantiated has not been released.
That's correct. They declined to give it to us promptly and instead directed us to file a Freedom of Information request. I expect that if we do get that letter, there's a chance it'll be heavily redacted.
Bill, you've been covering the governor for a lot of years, including covering Jacob. How does this episode, this alleged leak, notch into Cuomo's history of stumbling when it comes to involving himself or his administration in ethics matters?
Well, one of the longtime critiques of Cuomo, but Jacob even more specifically, is that ethics in New York is dominated by the governor. He has more appointments than anybody else on this commission. And if it's true that there is this back door that's kind of funneling secret information to him, that would just add fodder to this critique that we've heard from people like Republicans for years now, that this is Cuomo's Jacob, not some independent ethics entity. And that does tie into the broader critiques of ethics in Cuomo over the years with the Moreland Commission, which is supposedly independent, but he kept his fingers on throughout the process and opined, let's say, on what they should investigate and who they shouldn't investigate.
Could this be a goad to actual reform at Jacob? The governor, in his lone gubernatorial debate with Mark Molinaro, we should say Mark Molinaro, who along with Ed Cox made the complaint about Joe Prococo that finally, after they had to bring legal action to compel a vote, resulted in this vote that appears to be at the center of this dispute. Cuomo said, I'd like to see more independence from Jacob, whether that means independence in terms of appointments. But there was no follow-up.
Honestly, this might make it more difficult to reform Jacob in some ways. I think one of the reforms that's been percolating for a few years that seems like the easiest one to pass because it has a lot of support from a lot of different quarters is making Jacob more open about who they investigate. We've seen a lot of complaints over the years where 3 years later we're still talking about, did they even vote to investigate this person? Did they take an investigation? Because if they don't take action, we never know that they voted to find that somebody didn't do anything wrong. Jacob itself has supported opening up that process more. A number of legislators have, and that seems like an easier push than a lot of other ethics reforms. But now that they're being like critiqued for this, it almost makes it more complicated because of the fact that this leaked in such a weird way. So we'll have to see. But that being said, there were some talks last year, like there have been for pretty much every year Jacob's around, of basically nuking it and creating an entirely new entity. This will add kindling to that. If it's enough, I don't really know. Like, it's not like an issue where, you know, we've seen a lot of the new senators talk about making this a priority. Longtime senators like Liz Krueger have talked about it, but it's not like it's one of those bills that has passed the assembly every year and not gone anywhere in the Senate. There doesn't seem to be even more two out of three way interests of the three parties that govern state politics. So I think we have a ways to go, but we'll have to see.
Brendan, this is all happening as Jacob is apparently finalizing the search for a new executive director. Seth Agata, who basically took this complaint from Julie Garcia, resigned in June. They've been without an actual executive director now for 5 months, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And It also comes as, you know, the commissioners themselves will tell you privately that they want more transparency, and they've asked for that, and it's fallen flat. And at the same time, they would love nothing more than a leader, an executive director, who would be beyond reproach, somebody that would not be linked to Governor Cuomo. They can't seem to get that, and I think it's frustrating for them. You know, the idea that the commissioners themselves are part of this inner circle, I don't think is fair. I think many of them have been there and trying to do a really good job. It's when you get the leaks back like that to the governor, allegedly, where things start to fall apart. Their own credibility comes called into question, and I think they take issue with that.
Moving to another subject, Bill, you have been covering the deliberations of the Campaign Public Finance Commission, which is now less than 2 weeks away, apparently, from issuing its report. This week brought, as we noted at the top of the show, significant decisions on proposed max donations for legislative candidates.
Yeah, one of the big things that they're tasked with doing is setting contribution limits. Initially, what has been talked about for years has been, if we have a public financing system, the people who opt into that and get matching funds will have lower contribution limits because they'll need to raise less money, arguably. And one of the surprise decisions they made at a meeting earlier this week was to kind of create one contribution limit whether or not you're a part of the system. So you could be a candidate accepting public donations but still raising just as much money as somebody who didn't participate in the system. We haven't finalized all those limits yet, but they are going to be a lot higher than people were expecting or hoping for. For the state Senate, for example, it'll be about $10,000, which is about half of what they are right now. But that would still leave us pretty much at the top of the country in terms of the highest contribution limits for legislative candidates. Not a clear leader like we've been for decades, but among the top of the pack. And gubernatorial candidates, we don't have a decision on yet, but the number that was kicked around by Commissioner Jay Jacobs, one of Cuomo's appointees, was $25,000, which once again is a significant cut from the nearly $70,000 that somebody like Andrew Cuomo can receive now. But people have pointed out that if you're advertising this as a way of making small money a bigger part of our political system, most average people are not going to be writing $25,000 checks to Andrew Cuomo.
And if a candidate opts into the system and somebody gives him $25,000, does that mean that sum could be matched then by public funds?
A portion of that sum, at least the way that they're going right now, it would be like the first $250 of every sum would be eligible for, of every donation would be eligible for a match. So he's not going to be getting a $150,000 for that, but he'll get a couple thousand bonus bucks, quite possibly.
Meanwhile, there was a proposal as well to make it tougher to for a minor party, or any party for that matter, to earn ballot access. It's currently set at 50,000 votes in a gubernatorial election. In other words, if your party's gubernatorial candidate gets 50,000 votes, you've earned 4 years of presence on the state ballot. Jay Jacobs proposed boosting that considerably, right?
Yeah, this has kind of been the big question in the background of this commission ever since it was created. For months, we were talking about, would this ban fusion voting or change the rules on fusion voting? Pretty much everybody involved seems to have shifted away from that in the past few weeks. But as you mentioned, Jay Jacobs recently floated in the New York Times, raising the threshold from 50,000 to 250,000, which would mostly eliminate minor parties in New York State. If you go back to 2018, the Conservative Party got 253,000, so they'd be right on the cusp most years if that pattern continues.
Barely, yeah.
But everything, no other party got even half that amount. Like the Working Families, Libertarians, Greens, they'd all basically be having to come up with new strategies or give up their existence in automatic ballot access. Now the 250 has been dialed back a little bit. Like the number I'm hearing kicked around the most right now is probably 150,000, which is still increasing the work. Like when we're going back to parties like the Greens, Working Families, Libertarians, we're talking like 100 to 120, which is what they got the last time. So they would need to step up their efforts, but it's doable. But certainly their continued existence in state politics would not be guaranteed if something like that happened.
Very quickly, we got about 90 seconds left, but Pete King, congressman from Long Island, announced that after more than a quarter century in the House, he is going to not seek re-election next year.
Go ahead. I was going to say, and when he got congratulated by Senator Chuck Schumer, of course, that announcement caught fire suddenly, and a lot of people took issue with Senator Schumer crediting him in part for the work they had done, as we know, post 9/11, getting help for New York State.
Yeah. Just a very anodyne statement. I mean, who are some of the candidates who might end up stepping in?
Right now, the field still seems pretty open. I think one of the big questions, at least on the Democratic side, is Luba Gretchen Shirley. She ran against Peter King last year, in 2018. He had won his previous three races by an average of 27 points apiece. She lost by only 6. And now that it's an open seat, it seems like she would be a very strong contender if she was in. But as of now, she said she's considering it, but she hasn't entered. But other than that, we're looking at a wide list of candidates on both sides of the aisle. Some names like have been floated, on, including state legislators like Senator Phil Boyle has been floated. And we'll leave it at that.
We'll leave it at that. All right, that's all the time we have. Thanks very much to Brendan Lyons from the Times Union and Bill Mahoney from Politico, who got to watch last Sunday's Bills game with the governor.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org. Until next week, I'm Ray Suarez. This is New York Now.